Well, so yesterday we started a project, which we'll finish today, and that is to just go over the entire Gadata. We did most of it, we'll finish it today, and we are now on Daf Zayin Amud Beis, and we're up to Shamoa Bein Achichem Ushafatetem. So let's just count up from the bottom. 1, 2, we're on Daf Zayin Amud Beis, yeah? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines up from the bottom. Shamoa Bein Achichem Ushafatetem. So let's just take a minute to read the whole pasuk. And it reads the following: Vatzaveh shoftechem ba'eis ha'hilemar, beginning of Sefer Dvarim, Shamoa bein achechem u'shefatetem tzedek bein ish u'bein achiv u'bein gero. So the Gemara is going to dash in pretty much every single word in this pasuk, and we're going to start with Shamoa. Shamoa bein achechem. Amar Rabbi Chanina. Azhara lebezdin shelo yishma hadayon divrei baldin kodem sheyovo baldin chavero. So this is a prohibition that the dayon shouldn't listen to the claims of one of the two litigants before the other litigant shows up in bezdin. And not only that, the Gemara is going to darshan shamoa in two ways. Shamoa is to listen, and shamoa means to be heard. To listen is a prohibition that's addressing the judges, that they shouldn't listen. They should only listen bein achechem, when the two litigants, the two brothers, so to speak, are in front of them. One to the right, one to the left. But now, the azhara lebal din, now we're going to read Shamoa, not as to hear, but to be heard. That's called Shama, which is in causative. And that means Azhar al-Baldin shalo yat'im dvarav. Yat'im means to give an explanation, mean give his reasoning or his argument. Ladayon, in front of the judge, kodem, before Sheyava Baldin Chavero, before the other litigant shows up. And how do we derive that? Kari Beinami. We have another way of reading the word Shin Mem Ayin, not just as Shamoa, but also as Shama Bein Achechem, which means that your arguments and claims should be heard between the two of you when the other litigant is present. And Rav Kahan is going to come to the same conclusion from a different pasuk. This pasuk is back in Shmos, in Parshas Mishpatim. It says Mehocha, from this pasuk it says Lotisa, and then it says Shema Shov. Now Lotisa means Lotekabel, don't accept something. And this is a warning to the judge that if he hears the claims of one of the two litigants, and in the absence of the other litigant, then he will violate Lotisa, which means Lotekabel. You shouldn't receive it and accept it, because once he hears one argument, he starts getting, he starts getting emotionally connected to that argument. But we're going to read it again in a causative. We're going to change the vowels around, the vocalization, and read it as lotasi, which means to cause the judges to be inclined towards your argument, because you put your arguments in front of the judge before the judge hears the other claims of the other litigant. Now the Gemara goes back to the beginning of this pasuk that we started with, right? Shamoa bein achechem u'shfatetem is the middle part of the pasuk, but the opening part of the pasuk is vatzaveh es shofteichem, etc. And the Gemara quotes Reish Lakish. Now it's very interesting when the pasuk says Vatzaveh shoftechem ba'eis ha'hi lemar, and then it continues and it says u'shefatetem tzedek. And the Gemara is a little bit confused here. Why does it have to say u'shefatetem tzedek, that you should you should judge with justice, with honesty. I mean, that's what Mishpat is all about. There's no such thing as a Mishpat without Tzedek. So what is Moshe Rabbeinu emphasizing here when he addresses himself to the judges and he says you should judge with Tzedek, on Reish Lakish, Tzedek es hadin v'achakach chodchehu. Tzedek means not that the judgment should be just and should be honest and righteous, but rather the din itself should be organized, meaning the decision that you make, and this is the command addressed to the Dayan, the decision that he makes in his heart should be in a matter of tzedek or tzedek. Tzedek means he should be so convinced that he's right that he can justify his decision without hesitation, without inhibition. And then, after he comes to the conclusion in his mind or in his heart that this is the clear path and this is the ruling that he should hand down, at that point he should go ahead chatchehu and he should paskin the din. So that's Reish Lakish, and this is a warning to the Dayan that he should be absolutely clear before he makes his decision. Now the end of the pasuk says Ushvatem tzedek ben ish uben achiv uben gero. What's this all about? So here the Gemara quotes Rabbi Yehuda. Om Rabbi Yehuda. Now Rabbi Yehuda is going to understand that ben ish uben achiv is a reference to two brothers who inherit their father's estate with his demise, and that's why the Torah uses the word achiv. Now, what happens is we need what's called a chalukas hanachlo, which means to divvy up the estate, and it should be a fair division. Om Rav Yehuda, afilu, even if it means that the judge has to distinguish between bein bayis le'aliyah. What does that mean? You have a house that has the main floor, and it has an aliyah, it has a roof to it. And the judge might be tempted to take the easy way out and simply divide it in the following way. Let one brother inherit the bayis and the other brother inherit the roof. But in truth, the roof has nothing built on it. So at this point, it's karka, but it's not worth anything. Well, I shouldn't say it's not worth anything, but it's certainly not worth something that's banui, that's already built. So therefore, the thrust of what Rabbi Yehuda is admonishing the judge is that he should be very careful. He shouldn't try to find an easy way out and say, well, he'll get to the right, and he'll get to the left, he'll get to the bottom, he'll get to the top. But rather, he has to make sure, lahashvos es hachaluka lefi erech ha'dechasim. He has to make sure that this chaluka represents the true value of the nechasim. So for example, let's say the aliyah, the roof is only worth 50 and the bayis is worth 100, he has to make sure that one of the yarshim should get not only the aliyah, the roof, but he should also get, let's say, 25% of the bayis. So in that sense, overall, the nechasim are being divided up 75-75 in an equal way. Not only that, the Torah ends this pasuk by saying, uben gero. Now, gero is a word which means migurim. Even in modern Hebrew, migurim means where people live, their domicile. And uben gero means that even within the bayis itself, forget about the roof, but even within the bayis, we have to divvy it up amongst the brothers in a very equal way. Now inside the house, besides just splitting the house into two, we have the appliances in the house, we have the furniture in the house. So Rabbi Yehuda says that even when it comes to the furniture, we have to be very careful about evaluating every piece of or even the appliances. Bein tanur likirayim. Tanur is a larger oven. Kirayim is a smaller oven. And it's worth less than a tanur. So he might say, well, let Reuven take the tanur, let Shimon take the kirayim. No, that's the easy way out. But you have to make sure that everything in terms of its market value is equal and each brother inherits that which is coming to him. So that is a push and a demand on the Yarshim for absolute justice. Now in the same section in the Torah, at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, when Moshe Rabbeinu addresses the judges, he says, "Lo sakiru panim b'mishpat." Now, literally, sakiru means to recognize. When you give someone recognition, first of all, what you're doing is you're giving him a certain preferential treatment. I recognize him. Like, for example, if somebody comes into an audience and there's a dais and the chairman, you know, the MC who's sitting at the podium, he sees in the audience, like the president of one of the organizations, and he calls him up to the dais. That's called takiru. That means to recognize him. On the other hand, if you give a person recognition, then what happens is you're inclined towards him in a very unique way, and the others feel a little bit left out. They feel a bit jealous. So Rabbi Yehuda says that what's the thrust of this prohibition? Lo sakirehu. We're talking about an ohev, Rashi says. Now, you have a special connection to one of the two litigants, and you recognize that fact. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that you recognize it by saying, "Oh, how are you? You're my good buddy," and you scare the living daylights out of the other litigant. But in some sense, you're going to recognize him and incline yourself towards him. Lo sakireu, don't be inclined towards him. Now here, Abosa, you may recall we have a fundamental machlokas between Rashi and the Rambam. We spent a lot of time on that. Rashi seems to assume that in this case, the judge has to exclude himself and he is disqualified for judgment. The Rambam seems to say, I'm sorry, That's the Rambam Shita. I mixed it up. Rashi Shita is that the Torah is just warning him that he has to be absolutely objective and not have any inclination and preference towards the Baal Din that's his Oev, that he has a close relationship with. The Rambam, on the other hand, goes very far. The Rambam says that based on our Gemara, we have to disqualify the judge. He's not qualified to judge a case of an Oev. Now, the simple pshat of the Gemara seems to indicate that Rashi is correct, because the Gemara is just telling the judge, don't be inclined towards him. Don't recognize him as your good buddy. But it doesn't say that you're possible. But we'll soon see, after we turn to Daf Ches Amud Aleph, that the Gemara seems to indicate that in the case of an Oev, he's possible. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer wants to expand on Rabbi Yehuda. He's not disagreeing with Rabbi Yehuda. And he's saying, Lo tinak rehu. What we mean here is, again, from the same word of lo sakiru, but if we conjugate it differently, lo sinakrehu is not miloshan hakara, but rather miloshan nechar. Nechar is an alien, a foreigner. And here Rabbi Lazar is addressing the case of a sone. In other words, you have a gripe, you have some sort of an altercation with this litigant, you're the dayan and he's the litigant. And lo sinakreu, what you do is you alienate him. You know, this is your great opportunity to take revenge. And again, the Rambam is going to say in such a case you have to recuse yourself from the judgment. And now we're going to get two stories. Here's the first story. Ushpezichne derav. Ushpezichne means the host. We're talking about either a case where Rav was traveling through a city, maybe even on more than one occasion, and a certain balabas, a certain individual, used to host him. Or more likely, we're talking about an inn, some sort of a hotel, and this is the host of Rav in the inn. And every time Rav went through that route, he would stay at that inn. And of course, because of the great honor of Rav, the host took great care of him. He gave him, what do we call it, something carpet, red carpet, right? Okay. He gave him the red carpet treatment. Asola Kami Ladina, once it happened that this host of Rav came as a litigant in front of Rav, and Rav is sitting in judgment. Amarlo, so this person, this litigant, wants to make sure that Rav recognizes him. You know, it may have been a couple of years since he was last hosted. He was a guest in his hotel. Lav, he asks him a rhetorical question. Lav ush pezichnayat. You know, weren't you my guest? You know, remind you of all the great treatment that I extended to you. Amalo, so Rav says, in, yes I do. Amale, so now this person turns to Rav and he says, Dina Isli. In other words, initially, when he met Rav, he didn't reveal to Rav that he had a judgment. Maybe they met outside of court. So he reminds Rav of their friendship, so to speak, of what he did on behalf of Rav, and he extended himself, or overextended himself on behalf of Rav. You know, sometimes you come to a hotel room and they have these complimentary gifts. You know what I mean? You get a free bottle of wine, or you get some bottles of water, you get some fruits, and so forth and so on. And sometimes you can go all out, you know, if you really want to make sure that this guest will be happy and will come again and again. So I'm just imagining that this hotel owner, you know, manager, he made sure that, you know, Rav had a beautiful complimentary gift when he ever came. So now he reminds him of that. Then he reveals to Rav, Dina Islay, I have a judgment and I'm coming to you because I want you to judge between me and another litigant. Amalei, so now we turn to the Afkes. Rav says to the fellow, Pasil no loch ledina. Now here's where the Rambam will gain the upper hand. The Rambam is going to take this literally, and it means that you now have made me possible, you have made me invalid and disqualified for the din, because an oev is not kosher ledin. And by the way, you and I would have said that an oev applies only in a case where they have a long-standing relationship. You know, it's David and Yonah's son. No, even such a limited relationship as the fact that Rav was treated well in his hotel, even though he probably paid the bills, that itself is enough to consider him an oev. And the Rambam says he's pasul adin. Tosas divya maskil pasilna reinterprets the Gemara. He holds like Rashi that the din of an oev and a soni is only lechatchila. It's not an absolute disqualification. Lechatchila, he has to be very careful to make sure that he's absolutely fair, objective, and just. So therefore, Markik Haya Atzmo, when Rav says to the owner of the hotel, he says, Pasil no loch, you have declared me as disqualified. Rav was just being Markik himself. He wanted to stay away from this case. He felt, you know, even though he thought maybe on one intellectual level he could be objective, but on another level he wouldn't be successful. According to the strict letter of the law, if we were codifying the law, there's no such thing as a psul ohev. But Rav wanted to avoid it.
The line is very subjective.
We don't know exactly who's considered an ohev. Very difficult. Amalei, Rav. So Rav turns to his great student, this is his disciple, Rav Kahana, and he says, Puk Daine, you go out and substitute, replace me, and Daine, and you should judge this case. Now, the litigant is very excited about this, because he thinks that Rav Kahana certainly wants to make his Rebbe happy. And since Rav himself excluded himself because he knew that he would be inclined towards this hotel owner, as we called him, so Rav Kahana would likewise be inclined towards him. And Chazi, Rav Kahana noticed, Da'aviko Goyesbe. Goyesbe means, this is what you call body language. Goyes means somebody relies on himself, or he's absolutely sure of himself. So that's the way this litigant presented himself in the din. You know, he thought that I could rely on Rav, and now on Rav Kahana, who is basically representing Rav, that Rav Kahana is going to do everything in his power to judge in his favor. Omolei, so if Kahana saw what was going on, he turns to the hotel owner and he says the following: Don't think you're going to remain under the influence of Rav, you know, who's inclined towards you because of your relationship. But rather he threatens him. He says, Itzayis, tzayis. If you're going to listen to my psak, and it could be that my psak, my ruling, is going to go against your better interest, then that's fine. But ilo, if you think that you can reject my final ruling because you have the protection of Rav, is mafik nulcha Rav. I'm going to take you out of Rav, meaning out of the influence of Rav. Me'unach means from your power. You think you have power of Rav. You know, you have Rav backing you up over here. Oh, no. Forget about Rav. Rav's not going to come to your help. I'm going to give the final verdict, and it's going to be absolutely objective, and you better listen to the verdict. Now, at this point, the Mefarshim add another element into the equation, that part of the threat of Rav Kahana from the get-go was that if you refuse to accept my ruling and you think you can appeal to Rav and have Rav influence, then I'm going to put you into Nidui. Nidui means a kind of excommunication. So he really had a threat over him. And that's what we mentioned before about a shofar. You remember one of the four utensils that a dayan has to be equipped with. Now, the next pasuk.
What does excommunication actually mean?
Nidui means two things. Number one, it means the menuda has to act as an ovel. So you know, an ovel for 7 days has to comply with 11 different isurim. Mm-hmm. So, for example, an ovel is not allowed to wash his body. He's not allowed to wear shoes. A menuda has to also be in that state. The Ramban, you know, the Ramban wrote an entire treatise on Avelus. It's called Toras HaAdam, and the Ramban came up with a term called Nivul. Nivul. Now, it's very difficult for me to translate Nivul because I don't know the proper English word, so I'm just going to describe it to you. You'll tell me what the proper English word is. Have you ever seen, I don't know if you've ever been down in Manhattan, in lower Manhattan, called the Bowery? Nivul means a person who's living, you know, without a roof over his head, so to speak. Again, this is just figurative.
A bum.
And he's unkempt, you know, he doesn't take showers, never, and his hair is wild, and so forth and so on. So that whole picture is called Nivul. And the Ramban identifies Avelus as Nivul, that the Avel should feel that the last thing in the world that he wants to do is beautify himself, because now he's in this state of feeling down on himself, and he should live that out, so to speak, by abstaining from all the different things that an Avel has to abstain from. Then there's something called a Menuda, who's in a state of Nidui. He also has to comply with those 11 prohibitions. So he won't be able to wash his body, he won't be, right, different dina, but he won't be able to wear shoes. And in such a case, a menuda is in a state of nivul. So for lack of a better word, I would say unkempt, you know, like a homeless or a hobo type of person who really doesn't take care of himself because he doesn't have the wherewithal to do so.
For how long does
So right. Normally menuda is 30 days, but there is such a thing as a more severe violation in which the nidui might be extended for a longer period of time. I just want to point out again, this is an hour's discussion, so don't ask me about it, but there's a fundamental difference between the nivul of Avelus and the nivul of nidui, in that the nivul of Avelus that the Ramban describes is what we call a means to an end. The ultimate end is what we call avelus, that he should be in a state of grief and mourning. Because if you bury the dead without grief and mourning, you're considered cruel. You're heartless. Not so in the case of Nidui. He's not trying to generate a kiyum shebelev, you know, to get into a state of mind or of emotion. These are the surim that apply b'toras atzman. These are inherently also to a Nidui. Now there's another element of Nidui, and that is our relationship, the public, to the Menuda. And that's Yarchik. That means we have to stay away from him, we don't walk in close proximity, we don't do any business dealings with him for that period of 30 days. The Sugya of Nidui is in different places in Shas, but mostly in Moed Katan. And the Rambam actually dedicates an entire chapter in Hilchas Talmud Torah, of all places, to the laws of Nidui. And everybody asks, why did the Rambam classify Nidui on the Hilchas Talmud Torah? The answer is because the prime case of Nidui is someone who scoffs at a Talmud Chacham. He disrespects a Chacham, and then the Chacham puts him into Nidui, or other Chachamim put him into Nidui, and therefore the Rambam codifies all the laws of the Chachamim in Hilchas Talmud Torah, including the laws of Nidui. Now the pasuk goes on. Moshe commands the judges, Kakaton, Kagadol, Tishma'un. You should hear cases that can be described as Katon, with smaller cases, and they should be in your eyes like gadol, like they're great cases, like they're multi-million-dollar cases. Amrei Shlokish, shehei chaviv olecha din shel pruta kedin shel mea mona, that you should take seriously and with the same gusto a din that has to do with one pruta as if it were a din of mea mona. I mean, you're talking about 172 to 1, right? In other words, one dinar is 192 prutos. One dinar is 192 prutos. So multiply that by 10, right? And you get 1972 prutos. You know, that's the ratio here, and that's what you have to consider. Lamai Ilchasa, what does Reish Lakish have in mind? What does it mean that mentally, emotionally, the Dayan should consider it as if it was Mea Mana? Elam, if you're going to tell me, Li'i Yune Bey, to look into it, investigate it, Umifsake, before he hands out his psak, his ruling, Pshita? I mean, what are we going to... Do we really accuse? Is there a Havamini that Moshe thinks that Dayanim are not going to give a just ruling in a case of a Shava Pruta? Ella, what is Reish Lakish in his interpretation of Moshe Rabbeinu? What is he coming to attack? Lakdume, which means the case of the Pruta came in front of the Bezin first. You know, they signed up with the clerk, and now a multi-million-dollar case came in, and they signed in second. You might think, well, it's absolutely critical to judge the multi-million-dollar case first. Lakdume, let's give it priority and preference. And here we have a very serious Havamina that's what we should do. I'll tell you why. Because very often, in a case, in a multi, you know, in a very, let's say, a Dover Guttle, a really heavy case, you can get a hold of the litigant at a critical moment. And if the litigant is not brought into Beis Din at that critical moment, he may fly the coop. And now we're talking about a loss of multi-million dollars. You know, in the case of a pruta, chances are no one's flying the coop over here. They'll go to the courts and they'll litigate. Then the pasuk says, "Lo saguru mipnei ish," you should not be afraid of anyone. But literally, it means taguru. Means to gather something in. Like, let's say, for example, you have something that you go out and you inhibit yourself and you keep it inside. That's called lagure, to gather it together inside. So what does Moshe Rabbeinu mean when he commands the judges, lo tsaguru mipnei ish? So now here we have two different nuschos. There are two different texts or versions of the Gemara. We're going to read one version first. Amar Rabbi Hanan, al tachnis dvarecha b'pnei ish. In other words, if you have something to say as a judge, you want to hand down a judgment, don't take it in to your mouth, meaning don't hold it back, because you're afraid of somebody, you know, some mafioso, you know, that he might threaten your life, or threaten the life, chas v'shalom, your children. You know, the Torah is telling you that Mishpat has to be seen on the highest level. It's divine in its nature. Therefore, we have to be totally committed to truth. It's bad enough that the evildoers, that they take money out of the hands of one litigant and put it in the hands of the other litigant, against the law, because they're afraid of the repercussions if they do it otherwise. And you really have to be brave to be a judge. Rav himself said, if you remember yesterday, he considered it suicidal to take that position. They are pressuring me, says God, to return the money to its rightful owner. Words, even though God, you know, there's no such thing as tircha, you know, nothing is too hard for God, you know, he's omnipotent. But nevertheless, he doesn't want to break the laws of nature, he doesn't want to intervene in human affairs, but you're forcing me, if you judge improperly, and you, what was the word again? Not profane, what was the word we said? Pervert? Right, if you pervert justice, then God says, you're forcing me to get involved over here. HaMishpat LeElokim means ultimately God has to make sure that everything is just. So if you violate justice by finding this fellow liable to pay this fellow, when really in truth he's not liable, then God has to step in to make sure that that justice is met out, because God is the God of justice, and that's called Tircha. Then Moshe Rabbeinu turns to the judges and says something pretty surprising. If you have something that's too difficult for you, and then the end of the pasuk says, "Takrivun elai ushmatim," bring it to me, and I'll hear the case. So, in other words, if you have a din that's so difficult that you won't be able to come to any clarification, bring it to me. What does that sound like? What is Moshe doing? Yeah, anybody? Right, he's patting himself on the back. Yeah. He's like, I'm the big shot. You know, I'm the ultimate judge. I'll take care of all your hard cases. Some say it was Rav Oshia al Dover said, because of this statement of Takrivun Elai Ushmativ, bring me the hard cases, Nenash Moshe was punished. Shenemar in the parasha of Benos Slavchad, Vayakrev Moshe's Mishpaton Lifnei Hashem. That, and Moshe did not have an answer to their question about the Nachla. Do they, as girls, have rights to inherit their father's Slavchad? So Moshe had to bring it in front of God to get an answer. Why didn't Moshe himself know? Well, Hashem said, wait a minute, you're a big shot. You think you can solve all the difficult cases? Try this one on. You remember my story, my Hasidic story about conceit, about Gaiva. You remember that? This Chassid comes into the Rebbe and he says, Rebbe, you have to cure me from a disease. I'm suffering from a disease. So the Rebbe says, what's your disease? He says, Gaiva, I'm conceit. I think I'm the greatest. So the Rebbe says to him, come back tomorrow. So he comes back tomorrow and he seats him right on his left. First guy comes in and he has a very serious business enterprise. He doesn't know whether to invest money or not invest money. So the Rebbe says, wait a minute. He turns to the Chassid and he says, what are you recommending? He says, Rebbe, I have no experience in business. I don't know what to say. Anyway, the next guy comes in and he has an issue about marriage. You know, there's a little bit of friction and this and that. So he turns to the Chassid and he says to him, what do you advise? He says, Rebbe, I have no experience in marriage. Third guy comes in and he has a halachic shaila about a chicken. Is it treif? Is it not treif? Turns to the chassid. The chassid said, Rebbe, I never pass on. System, I don't understand. Knowledge you don't have. Money you don't have. And good thinking. Why are you conceited? There's nothing to be conceited about. So when the Tzlafchad case came in, and Moshe Rabbeinu had said, give me all the tough cases. Okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to him as his chassid. And Rebbe turns to his chassid and said, all right, you tell me, what should we say to Bnos Slavka? And Moshe Rabbeinu says, I don't know. So what are you conceited about? But this is the opinion of Rabbi Chanina, but Rav Nachman rejects it. Maskifle, Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak. He asks the following question. Does it say, Va'ashmi Achem? Bring me the difficult cases and I will let you know, meaning I will tell you and you'll hear my verdict. Ushmativ ksiv, which means I will let it be heard. By whom will it be heard? Not because I'm going to hear it, Moshe, but it will be heard by the Almighty. Gmirna, if I happen to know the answer to the question, so I'll tell you. But Elo, if I don't, Azilna v'gamirna. I'm going to go up to the Ribbono Shel Olam, ask him the question, and I'll learn. So Moshe Rabbeinu was not proving gaiva, he was not showing off that he's the big shot. He was merely saying that if I don't know the answer, because it's a double question, it's very possible I won't know the answer either, I'll take the case in front of the Ribbono Shel Olam and he'll teach me the answer. Ella, so now we have to ask, so why didn't Moshe know the answer to the question of the Menos Slav? Because it wasn't a punishment for gaiva, but rather Kiddushanya, like we learned in Avraisa, Ru'uya, in the original divine plan, it made sense. Parshas Nachlos, the parasha of Nachla, of all the Yerushal laws, the inheritance laws, Shatikaseh, that it would be written down on the Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu would have known all the laws, in theory, even before a question would come in front of him. But God decided to leave out a certain part of the inheritance laws, that Moshe Rabbeinu would not be able to write it. In other words, he wasn't a scribe that was listening to the dictation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that was the question of women, you know, whether the women could inherit their father. Elo shezachu b'no slavcha. Why is it that God left out this information? Because he wanted to give a merit to these tzidkanios, these saintly women. So also, when you go home and your wife asks you, what were you doing in Rabbi Berzon's shiur? So she'll tell him, we were learning about you, your great tzedekes. You know, we were learning about the importance of a woman, of a woman who's a saintly woman. Today you could probably fill up a library about, you know, biographies for all the saintly women that we have. But he says the following: V'nichtav al yadon, they were the vehicle through which this parsha was written. Not only that, there's another parsha that was left out of Moshe Rabbeinu's writing that was given to someone else. It would have been appropriate, it would have been suitable for Moshe Rabbeinu to write the parsha Mekoshesh. Mekoshesh means a Mechal Shabbos, someone who desecrates the Shabbos. What punishment do we mete out to him? And we didn't know the answer to that question until finally there was a Mekoshesh, and we found out through the Ribbono Shel Olam that it was Skila, that we stone a person for violating the Shabbos under certain conditions, right? And this came through the Mekoshesh. But this is not good news. You know, the fact that the Torah is now telling us that the punishment for this violation is skila, is death, that's not something positive. Shenischayev haMekoshesh v'nichtav al yado. And since the Mekoshesh, who he was collecting wood, whatever he was doing over there, and he violated the Shabbos, then he deserves that a terrible parsha, we could call it like a klola, curse, because here it means a cardinal sin, he'll be condemned to death. Nichtav al yado, he would facilitate bringing down this parsha. So on the one hand, we have the Bnos Slavchad, who are the Tzidkanios, they're going to bring about this great parsha of Nachla. And on the negative side of the equation, we have the parsha of Skila for Machal Shabbos. That's going to be brought about through the catalyst here, the agency of Mekoshesh. Lelamdecha, in both these cases, we derive the following principle: Megalgalin chov al yidei chayov, v'schus al yidei zakai. The God wants some chov, some negative limud in this case, you know, some teaching to be brought about through someone who's negative. Right, he's a chote, he's a desecrator of the Shabbos, and in the case of Zchus, you know, some beautiful parsha about inheriting the land of Israel, this is going to come through the Zakai, through the Blos Slavchad, because they are such.
Question before you continue. So, two things. One, I think I read someplace that wasn't the Slavchad, the father, was the guy who went out on Shabbat and he had to be killed. That's why he was. He was dead at the time.
Right, but this Gemara doesn't seem to support
that.
No, you're right. I'm saying there are many opinions, but this Gemara that we're learning now does not seem to support that view.
Right.
Because it doesn't seem... Well, you know what? It's still...
But it ties in, because you got both ends of the... No, this is the father
right.
and the daughter.
But the question is, if you hold... You see... Slavchad is known as a tzaddik. If he was the Mekoshesh Eitzim, he was willing to sacrifice his life in order to scare the people
right.
about how severe the desecration of Shabbos is, that they'll get a very cruel they'll meet their very cruel death as a punishment for desecrating the Shabbos.
Right.
Here the Gemara is saying Megalgalin Choval Yidei Chayav, which means that we don't view this in a positive light. We view it in a very negative light. So I don't know if this particular chazal will reflect the shita that Slavchad was the Mekoshesh Eitzim. I don't see a footnote here. Let me just quickly, I don't want to waste too much, because I want to achieve my goal.
I have another question.
Okay, wait. Let me just open up the page and then you'll ask me a question. Just want to make sure I can find the page and see if there's anything here in the back. You know, this is the Yalkut Biurim, if he has anything about the Mekoshesh Eitzim. Just give me a second here and then you'll ask your second question. But let me just see. Is there anything here about the Mekoshesh Eitzim? So far, I'm not seeing anything here about the Mekoshesh Eitzim. So you better ask your second question. Maybe I'll.
Okay. So in light of what it's saying here, that Moshe didn't apparently write these so who wrote it?
No. It doesn't mean that Moshe didn't write it. Moshe didn't write it until a later period of time when it was clarified. So initially, at a certain historical moment, Hashem left it out of the writing. Right? Let's say, for example, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the Torah in five different stages.
Right.
So when he got to Parshas Matos, which is the Parsha of Nachla, this particular detail was left out. Until later on, in Parshas Sefer Bamidbar, when the Tzlofka and Benoslofka would come forward and Hashem would give him the answer, then he would write it down.
So this is... Okay, so for another discussion, because it's too long, I don't want to interrupt.
Ooh, just one second. I think I found something for your first question. Kosav Achsam Sofer, Aviem, their father, meaning the father of the Benoslofka, Hoye Mekoshish Eitzin, of the Osakein L'Shem Shamayim, he was motivated by the right reasons. Kidei sheyishmu kol Yisrael v'yiro milchal Shabbos. Oh, l'fichach nichtava parshas Nachlos al yedei bnos Slovcha mishum sheba nemar l'Moshe losis lem Nachla al shem Avien. Val yada nosan Moshe liavien shem Olam shehu scharam shel shomrei Shabbos. Yeah, but he's not answering my question. The Gemara says, "Megalgalin choval yedei chayev." So, in second, Lonis Bayer. Yeah, I don't see that he. I got very excited about this, but he definitely supports the view that Slavchad was l'shem shamayim, and part of the great schus that Slavchad got as payment for his L'Shem Shamayim was that Moshe Rabbeinu would give the Benos Slavchad an eternal acquisition in the land of Israel.
But it doesn't say what he did.
Yeah, but Koshesh means he gathered together. That's called Meleches Ma'amer. I mean, that's a sugya Masechta Shabbos. In fact, the Rishonim want to know, why isn't he part of Midin, Melech Shem Tzich L'Gufa? He didn't need to be Mekoshe. He only did it because he wanted to publicize, you know, this Chiv Misa. So that should be Melech Shem Tzich L'Gufa. I don't want to get off on a tangent on that. But anyway, the Pasuk in Yeshaya, which we read on Etainis Tzibur, in Perek Nun Vav, says, Ki ko amar Hashem l'sarisim asher yishmu eshav sosai. So apparently the Chassam Sofer wants to claim that this is an allusion to Slavchad, Asher Yishmu Shepsosai, meaning as a result of Slavchad's bold action, the Jewish people would be dedicated to observe the Shabbos, at least out of Yira, out of fear. V'nasati lahem v'veisi v'chomosai yad v'shem tov mi banim u'banos shem olam etei lo. So the person who's dedicated to the Shabbos, and this is an allusion to Slavchad, will have a shem olam. And what will be his shem olam? Bibesi b'chomosai means in Eretz Yisrael, and he'll have an eternal possession in Eretz Yisrael, meaning he died without any son. So what was the chance in a million that he would get any shame olam in Eretz Yisrael? I mean, the Yerusha goes through the males. No, in this case, the Yerusha is going to go through his daughters, and therefore he'll have a shame olam. So this is all a reward that's bestowed upon Slavchad. But let's go on, Rabbosa, because again, I'll be very frustrated if we don't get to our finish line here. Ksiv, the Pasuk says, Vatzaveh es shofteichem ba'es hahi. You know, as Moshe commands the judges to guide the people of Israel at that time, based on the law of the Torah. Uksiv, Vatzaveh eschem ba'es hahi. In the very next pasuk, or two psukim later, it says, "And I command the people of Israel at that time." So it's very interesting. On the one hand, the first pasuk indicates that Moshe is commanding; he's commanding the shoftim. He's addressing himself to the shoftim that they are getting a certain a certain command or mandate vis-a-vis the tzibur, and on the other hand, the next pasuk indicates that no, that God is addressing himself to the tzibur, to the rank and file citizen, that they should listen to the shoftim. So the Gemara says, Omar Rabbi Loza, Omar Rabbi Samloi, they're both correct. Azhara l'tzibur shetei emas adayin aleim, azhara l'dayin sheyizbol as atzibur. There is a reciprocal relationship here. That on the one hand, vatzaveh eschem, and on the other hand, vatzaveh shofteichem. The vatzaveh eschem, which is addressing itself to the tzibur, means shetei emas adayin aleim. They have to have awe and respect, they have to put the Dayan on a pedestal, have esteem for the Dayan. But on the other hand, the Pasuk says, Vatzaveh Shoftechem, that's really a mandate to the Dayan that he should be very tolerant of the Tzibur, which means that when the Tzibur has certain needs and they come forward to complain because they need certain things, right? There's no water, you know, there's no food, then the Dayan has to be very tolerant. Yizbol. Yizbol means he has to suffer, so to speak, together with the tzibur for all their needs. So again, there's a reciprocal relationship here of honor. Ad kama. How far does it go when the Torah says to the Dayan, addressing himself, addressing the Dayan Atzaveh Shoftechem, that he has to be sovel the tzibur, as if to say he has to identify and empathize with the needs of the tzibur, how far does it go? Amar Rabbi Hanan, v'itei modusei was Rav Shabtai. He says you have to deal with the tzibur how? The way Moshe Rabbeinu said, Kasha Yisa Ha'omein Esayonik, like a nursing father carries a baby. In other words, you are like almost a parent with your compassion and your concern and your empathy towards the people which are like your children. And you have to deal with them as a father would deal with a child. Ksiv. Moshe turns to Yoshua, and we'll soon see that God turns to Yoshua, but in two different sentences or formulations. First we have Moshe Rabbeinu. At the end of the Torah, he turns to Yoshua and he says to him, I'll add two words here, Chazak ve'matz, ki ato tavo, and the end of the pasuk is, Esa'om azeh, elo oretz asher nishba Hashem lavosom. Now the idea of tavo is the word tavo is to come, means that you come together with the people, tavo esa'om. But yet, At the very end of that same chapter, God addresses Yoshua, Uksiv, and he says to Yoshua, Chazak ve'matz, ki ato tavi es b'nei Yisrael, elo oretz asher nishbati lehem. Here instead of tavo, you're coming together with the people, tavi, you're bringing the people, as if you are the leader, and you have total sovereign rulership over them. That's called derech srora v'shilton. So who is Yoshua? What is his job? Is he one of the people, or is he above the people? Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar lo Moshe li Yoshua. Moshe turns to Yoshua and he says the following, Atov haskenim shebedorimcha. You are together with the zkenim, with the elders. Right, the elders were those who sat on the high court and had received smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu. These were the brilliant bekiyim in Torah, and they were the zkenim. And Yoshua, you're going to lead the people, lead them together with this Canaan. Meaning, don't do anything of major substance, don't make any decisions on your own without consulting with this Canaan. You are together with this Canaan, that's called Tavi Yasa'am. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to Yoshua and he says, no, I have a different approach. Tol Makel, Vahach Al Kod Kodom. You take a stick and hit them over the head. Meaning, that's your relationship to this Canaan. Why? Because Dabar Echad Lador, the ancient Dabarim Lador. A Dabar is a manig, a leader, and there's only one leader for each generation. There's no generation that's being led by two leaders. And therefore, Hashem is basically neutralizing what Moshe said. Moshe said to Yoshua, don't be such an independent big shot. You have to deal with the, and you have to be together with this Canaan. And you know, your judgment should be a result of consulting with this Canaan. And Hashem says, no, don't pay any attention to this Canaan. There's only one leader in the generation. So this is very interesting that, you know, Hashem, so to speak, corrects Moshe Rabbeinu here. And we had a long discussion about this, if you recall. Maybe we'll get a chance to review it. But we got up to Tana. Now, this piece of Tana is almost like the last Agadita of this very long Agadita that we've been dealing with. But yet, it's not really an Agadita. It's really a halacha. Now, in order to appreciate what this Gemara is all about, we have to know two things. We have to know, number one, that there's something called zimun. Okay, now if three people eat together, then they do what's called a zimun, correct?
Mm-hmm.
In which one person invites the other two, let's bench together. Rabbi Sina Varech, or whatever language you want to say it in. We used to say rubber tires never break, whatever it is. And you get together for a zimun. That's introduction number one. Introduction number two, and this is not really working for me, but maybe you have something that maybe... Oh, thanks. Is there something called a shliach beitin? A shliach beitin. Now, a beitin, generally, even on the lowest level court, is made up of three judges. The shliach has to represent all three judges. So let's say, for example, if Bezdin wants to subpoena someone to show up in court because one litigant has a claim against another person, so they send the shliach to knock on Reuven's door. They say to him, the shliach says to Reuven, you're being subpoenaed to show up in the court. So Reuven has the right to say, well, show me a document. And the shliach shows him a document. Now, if we assume that the Bezdin is made up of three judges, and now the shliach is representing those three judges, then the document that he produces to invite someone to Bezdin has to be signed by all three judges. And that's perhaps the Gemara that we want to learn now. Tana, we learned in a Braisa. By the way, I never understood, if anyone could set me straight on this, what's the difference between Tana, Tanya, and Tana, Tanya, and Tana Rabbana? I don't know, I never understood that. I'm sure it's in the book somewhere.
Mishnah,
Braisa. Well, Tana here means a Braisa, but you're saying Tana could also mean a Mishnah. Okay, here means a Braisa, but okay. Tanina certainly needs a Braisa. Tana Rabbana certainly means a Braisa. I don't know exactly. Anyway, Tana, so we learned in a Braisa. Zimun Bishlosha. So I've also said, when I want to bench together with two other people, we have to form a quorum of three. Okay? So the Gemara says, my zimun. What does the word zimun mean? Because literally, the translation of the word zimun is an invitation. Elema, if you're going to tell me it means lebirkas hamazon, that one person invites two other people to be mevarech. Vatanya, we have a braisa that says zimun ubirkas zimun bishlosha. Do you see how there are two categories? They both require three. One category is called zimun, and the other category is called birkas zimun. So therefore, when we started with the price that zimun requires shlosha, it could not possibly be referring to birkas zimun, because that would be birkas zimun. That wouldn't be zimun. There must be some difference between zimun and birkas zimun. V'chitem, and don't tell me, v'chitem means, and if you'll tell me, but I'm going to reject this, perushi kamafaresh. Gee, if I'm not mistaken, that's called an appositive phrase in English, no? When you have, like, John, comma, or let's do it this way. Your brother, comma, John. Is that called an appositive phrase, if I remember from my childhood grammar? Anybody remember? No? Okay. It's been a while since we did English grammar. But anyway, that's called perushe kama farish. Perushe kama farish means that you use a word and then you explain the word. So I'm talking about a brother, and I'm telling you his name is John, right? I'm talking about zimun, and you have to know what zimun is. Zimun means birkas zimun. So then it's one thing. He says, no, that can't be. Why? Because by the time you have another braisa, right, so pirushikam afarish means my zimun, what is zimun? I mean, the Gemara, the Bryson never even asked this question explicitly, but implicitly, Zimun Kama, and in the space between the next two words, you ask my Zimun, you'll ask me what Zimun is, Birkas HaZimun. But it's all the same, it's all one. Name, that can't be. But Tanya, you have a Bryson that says Zimun Vishlosha, and Birkas Zimun Vishlosha. It can't be that the words Birkas HaZimun are coming to interpret Zimun, because if so, why did he separate it with the word Shlosha? Apparently there are two concepts that they're fundamentally different. One is called Zimun, the other is called Birkas HaZimun. The last one is referring to Birkas HaMazon. But what's the first one referring to? What's common about the two concepts here is that they both require three. Elamai Zimun, says the Gemara. This is the final answer to the Gemara. The word Zimun means what? Azmune Lidin. When you invite someone to show up in court, who's going to do that work? The Shliach Bezdin. And what is he going to do? Bishlosha. He has to invite the person, or I use the word subpoena, I hope I'm using it in the right way, subpoena a person to Bezdin in the name of the entire Bezdin, all three Dayanim. And I'll prove it to you. Ki hadi amar Rava. Here's the statement of Rava. Hani beit losa dayane. If you have three dayanim that are together, the yasvin, they're sitting together in judgment. The azil shlicha de beit dina. The shliach of the beis went out. He went out to subpoena someone to the court. The amar. And he says to the litigant, this future litigant, right, who's being called into Beis Din, he says to him, mi puma dechad. I'm inviting you in the name of, right? Bifur means in the name of Chad, of one of the two Dayanim, is Lo Amar Klum. That's not valid. Which means, now, Don, you asked me before about Nidui. Well, one of the classic cases of Nidui, there are many cases of Nidui, but one of them is what's called a Sarvan. Okay? Sirev is the verb. And the noun that describes a person who does this kind of thing is called a sarvan. Lisarev, even in modern Hebrew, in the state of Israel, means to refuse. Lisarev, ani misarev. Now, if a person refuses to show up in Beis Din after they sent a shliach in the name of the Beis Din, he's a sarvan, and they put him into nidui, which is not very pleasant. So that's the power of the Beis Din, with the shofar that we spoke about, against the dayanim, against the litigants, to force them in when they are subpoenaed into Beis Din. But in this case, says Rava, Omar mi puma dechad. He said that Judge Shmuel sent me, you know, on this mission. I speak in the name of Shmuel, one of the three dayanim. Right? There was Shmuel, and there was Levi, and there was Yitzchak, you know, the three dayanim. And he says, I was sent in the name, you know, he produced a document, and guess what? There's only one judge signed on the document. It's Lo Amar Klum. That's not considered a Zimun. Why? Because Zimun requires Shlosha. Not the Zimun of Birkas HaZimun, which requires Shlosha, but the Zimun of the Shliach when he knocks on the door of someone and it subpoenas him to show up in Beis Din. You know, in divorce law in America, they call it to deliver papers. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that phrase? That's a scary business. Okay, no one should know from that. But here he's delivering papers that he has to show up in court. Again, I don't want to be on the recipient the end of that thing. But the papers have to be signed by all three judges. Adi Omar Mishmei Dekulu. It has to be that the Shliach is representing all three judges. And now I have a Gemara that I don't understand. If you could help me with this. The Gemara says, Hani Mili, when is this true? That the Shliach only has the halachic legal status of a Shliach Beis Din for Zimun, which means that if he refuses to show up, we're going to put a zap him with a nidui. That's only below Yom HaDedina. It's not the Day of Judgment. I will be Yom HaDedina. If it's the Day of Judgment, less one bar. We don't care, even if he only mentions the name of one judge. Now, Rabbol said, what does it mean, the Day of Judgment? So I thought, before I saw Rashi, that the Day of Judgment meant that the judgment is going on right now. But that's impossible, and Rashi's going to give us an alternative explanation, because even if the judgment is going on now, that's exactly when the Shliach Beis Din shows up. by definition, there's no such thing as a shliach bezdin unless there's a judgment going on. During the course of the judgment, Reuven is suing Shimon, and the expectation is that Shimon will show up in court. So Rashi says, based on a Gemara Bava Kama, that Ezra made a takana, that there would be 2 days out of every week, which would be the days of judgment. Which 2 days are that?
Monday
and Thursday. This has tremendous repercussions. For example, the Gemara tells us that the Bnei Akfarim, the people who lived in the villages, they would come in to the big cities when? On Mondays and Thursdays. And that was market-based. So once the people were in there, then they established that they would also accomplish din, that the judges would be sitting waiting for litigations, possible litigations. So when, well, the Gemara Megillah says that if, let's say, Purim Yudalid Vadar falls out on a, on a Sunday, and the Bnei Akfarim are not expected to show up. Okay, that's not a good example. Let's say Purim falls out on a Friday, right? And the Bnei Akfarim, the villagers are not going to show up in the big city to hear Megillah. They didn't have their own local readers, so they had to come to the city slickers to hear one of the great Bali Kriya. So they wouldn't be coming in until they would be counting Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, another 3 days. So the Gemara says that it could be a Kriya of Megillah as early as Yud Aleph, which is 3 days before Yud Aleph. All this has to do with the Takana of Ezra, that Mondays and Thursdays, and the Gemara says above Kama, why did Ezra choose it that way? He wanted the structure that everyone would hear the Torah without letting 3 days go by without hearing the Torah. So if you heard the Torah Monday, then Tuesday, Wednesday, you didn't hear the Torah, but you heard it on Thursday, then you had Friday, and then Shabbos you heard the Torah. Now from Shabbos you had Sunday, and then Monday. But there would never be a 3 day period without hearing the Torah. That's based on the parasha of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So Rashi invokes this whole sugya of Yom HaDinah, that there are 2 days in every week, that's Mondays and Thursdays, that are dedicated to Din. On these 2 days, if the Shliach Beis Din shows up, even if he has the signature of only one judge, he can force, through his agency of Zimun, that litigant to show up in Beis Din. If the litigant doesn't show up, then we're going to put him into Nidu. And why? Because it's a Monday or a Thursday. Maybe there's some sort of anticipation that if a person is called into din on a Monday or Thursday, he realizes that this is serious business. If only one judge is signed, he begins to think and he questions whether or not this is a real judgment. But if it's on the day of din, then he knows, like, that sort of convinces him that this is a serious zimun. I don't know. Unfortunately, I was let down on this occasion by Masifta, and there's not even one comment here in the Masifta. I don't know what's going on over here. But somehow, you know, he knows this litigant that's, you know, his door is being knocked on, he's handed papers as a zimun. He knows that the other two judges are sitting in judgment on that day of Monday or Thursday. He realizes that this is serious business. Okay, Rabose, so we'll stop here. And I'm very happy to say that we finished the Agadita. Tomorrow, B'li Neder, I would like to study with you, and please convince me that you have these pages. Peites and Sadid.
Only Peites. Only Peites.
You don't have Sadid.
No.
So you know what I would ask you? Let's see. What's on the back of your page? Do you have Peites on the other back?
Blank. We only have one sheet.
Blank. So, all right, I don't know. If we want to be...
You only gave me the one page. So
but I'm just saying, if we want to be stingy on the paper of the yeshiva, you could actually take your pages over to the machine and just flip it upside down. But if we don't... You know, so it'll be on the other side. Or it'll help you also because you'll have less pages to carry around. But that's up to you. In any event, this is what I have for you. Yeah, so I would say the following. Just wait one second, Don. I'm sorry. What I want to say is the following. If you're going to switch around your papers, then I'll give you all three. If, on the other hand, you're going to hold on to your pages, then I'll give you two. So you can double side that, okay? Double side this. Okay, there are both sides. So we'll stop here. I don't know if Reuven, you have any possibility of learning Mr. Brewer.